clones. Jim Rome here. Now, before we get it rolling with the Daily Jungle podcast, I want to let everybody know that I've been nominated for the National Radio Hall of Fame, and my category is voted on by you, the listener, and the polls are open right now. So do me the biggest solid you have ever done. If you're listening to this podcast on your phone, text the number 800 to 96,000. In other words, text the number 800 to 96,000. Do that right now and then come back to the podcast right after. If you're listening on your computer, just open up another tab and head on over to radiovote.com. That's radiovote.com, and you can vote for me right there as well. Remember, it's not an either-or proposition. You can vote twice. I need you to do both those things. And in the meantime, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your support. It's not my thing to go out stumping for votes, but I really do not have any choice this time. So thank you very much for listening, and thank you for voting. Now, let's get to the Daily Jungle.
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Despite what Braden Holtby said after Game 2, his save with 2 minutes left in Game 2 was big. It was big then, it's even bigger right now, because in the two games plus 2 minutes since then, the Capitals have been a juggernaut. And in the two games plus 2 minutes since then, the Vegas Golden Knights have not. They have not been the Vegas Golden Knights. And there was no greater example of that than early in last night's game when James Neal had a wide open net in the first period only to have this happen.
Right down the middle, and now the pass to Hall, and the pass to the back door, and shot, they hit the post on an open net, and a puck to the far wing. Oh, did the Caps get a break there as they clear?
They catch a big break. You know, Orpik didn't have a stick for about 30 seconds either. He had nothing down there. He couldn't do anything about it. And they miss a wide open net. Looks like James Neal doesn't miss too many of those.
Caps radio. No, James Neal does not miss too many of those. In fact, you give that guy that look 100 times, he probably buries it 100 times. But somehow, some way, that one did not go in. And it didn't go in when Vegas needed it to go in worse than they ever have. Not just because they were down 2-1 in the series or because they were on the road, but because suddenly these guys just cannot find the back of the net. And not only did that not go in, it did hit the post. Unreal. Afterwards, Neal said, quote, "It probably changes the game. It's probably a different game after that. I had a wide open net and I just hit the post." End quote. No probably about it. It is a completely different game if they come out 1-0 in the first few minutes on the road in a must-win situation. And if they find a way to score there and they get one past Holtby, then the entire game has got a different feeling and a different vibe. Then your offense gets into a flow. Then your confidence starts pumping. Everything changes. And if it is a different game, if it goes in, it's probably a different series. But it didn't go in. And suddenly, nothing will for these guys because the Caps are outplaying the Golden Knights and they're outlucking them. Vegas has hit the post 7 times in the last 2 games alone. And as always, if you don't cash in your opportunities at one end, your opponent almost certainly will do it on the other. And that's exactly what the Caps did.
Carrying along the left side by Backstrom. Kuznetsov and a shot, rebound, and score! T.J. Oshie!
T.J. Oshie at 9:54, and it opened up the floodgates. Tom Wilson, 6.5 minutes later.
Wilson strong out of the corner, leading for Kuznetsov on the pass in front, and a shot from Wilson. They score! Oh, what a play between Wilson and Kuznetsov! Tommy knocks it home!
And that's not all. Devontae Smith-Pelly, 3 minutes after that.
Now the Caps with Niskanen, a puck down low to Smith-Pelly. He scores! Devontae Smith-Pelly along the left post!
Just like that. Bam, bam, bam. 3 goals in less than 10 minutes. And instead of being up 1-0, the Golden Knights were suddenly down 3-0. Then John Carlson tacks on a fourth in the second period. It got so bad at one point, the Golden Knights Twitter account posted, and I quote, "Yo, hockey gods, we do something to upset you or what?" But then Vegas scored, and at Golden Knights tweeted, "Hey, hey, we got one." Then they scored again, and at Golden Knight was at it once again. 4-2, comeback time. But Washington scored 73 seconds later to make it 5-2, and then that was the game. Then came the chant. The chant the Caps fans have been looking to break out for years and have never had the chance. The chant was, "We want the cup. We want the cup." I mean, that's how good Caps fans are feeling. Doc Emrick was on the show yesterday. Hope you heard Doc. He was amazing. He came on the show yesterday, and he talked about the fact that the Caps fans are feeling it. That in the past, the Caps fans have always prepared for the worst to happen because the worst usually does happen. But not now. Now they've got swagger. Now they've got confidence. And it's because their team has got so much confidence. And they've got that confidence because they're the better team right now. And they're getting all the breaks and all the bounces while Vegas is getting none at all. Once again, if Neil starts that game and does not miss that wide open net, we could be looking at a totally different game. And if we're looking at a totally different game, we're probably looking at a totally different series. But instead of possibly being tied at two games apiece, now they're facing elimination, down 3-1. And while I did say right here yesterday, there are no true locks in sports, you go up 3-1 in the Stanley Cup Final, you're essentially a lock. The last 31 teams to do that went on to finish and cash it in. And it looks like the Caps are going to do it now because Marc-Andre Fleury suddenly looks mortal between the pipes. Nor are the guys in front of him giving him that much help either. My final thought, and I told you it's a monster hockey block. I love the Golden Knights. I think they're one of the best stories ever, no matter what happens. I could even argue you go ahead and throw dirt on these guys because I can't do it. I mean, yeah, it looks bad. But remember, these guys should have never been here in the first place. I could also point out that everybody left them for dead after Winnipeg smacked them in Game 1 of the conference finals. And we all know what happened then, right? They rip off 4 straight. They advance. No, it doesn't look good. In fact, it looks horrible. But this crew is different. Not dead, can't quit. Not dead, can't quit. And I can't officially bury these guys until they're dead. I could make that argument. I could easily make that argument. But I'm not going to. Because the fact is, they just look like they've lost that premium fuel and that juice that they're running on. They've lost their swag. Fact is, Vegas no longer looks like a team of destiny. The Caps do. And while choking away a 3-1 lead in the final would be the most Caps thing ever, it says here, that's just not going to happen. This is a different crew. It is officially their time. Finally.
I love Finally. When you talk hockey.
I love it when I talk hockey. What do you think? Are they going to finish it? They're up 3-1. I mean, these Caps are different, right? There's no way they choke away a 3-1 lead. Not even to Vegas. But Vegas is hard to kill. Except I think they've lost their juice and their mojo and their swag. 1-800-636-8686. Just know we talk hockey on this show. I'm proud of the fact that we talk hockey on this show. Right? Right, Bella? Don't you love when I talk hockey? I get that all the time. And not just from her. Paula Duca. Paul, it's great to have you on the program. How are you?
Good, Jim. How you been, man? Been a long time.
It's been a long time, bud. Good to have you back. Paul, thank you very much. You know, your roots in gambling, Paul, go back a little bit to when you were a kid and your father was involved. Let me start right there. How did you first get involved?
Well, you know, it was just engraved. You know, my father always used to take me to the racetrack when I was a kid, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, and somewhere in that area. And, you know, I was always going to the arcade, didn't really know what was going on until you know, my dad would hit big, and then I would sort of know, and then started to learn the sport more and more. And then when my father started owning horses, I started going to the backside and get to learn more about them, and then to learn more of the personalities of them. And it then changed my mindset. And then it turned into, you know, always had the gambling part in my background, but then it turned into, wow, I really love these animals and this sport. And, you know, my dad was always wagering on games and stuff like that. So we were always in a household wondering who was going to cover the spread. My dad always used to say, it doesn't matter who wins or loses, it's who collects the bet.
This Tuesday edition of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by Fan Exchange. If you're looking ahead to the weekend or the summer season in general, and you're thinking about getting out to the yard or a festival or a theater show, make sure you start that search with Fan Exchange. bust on over to fanexchange.com for a safe, easy, and reliable experience. A great experience. Tickets purchased on Fan Exchange are always guaranteed. There's no getting to the gate and then worrying about getting in. Fan Exchange gets you closer to the action. Find the very best seats at the best prices at fanexchange.com. Use the promo code ROME. Again, promo code ROME and get 50% off the service fees on your next purchase. Fan Exchange, we have tickets. Paul LaDuca joining us on the program. It's a great story. So you got the Belmont Stakes, Paul, coming up. And I know that's a race that has meant a lot to you for a long time. In fact, growing up, your dad used to tell you one story after another about the Belmont. What are some of the ones that stick out to you the most?
Well, the Secretariat story is the one that sticks out the most to me. Obviously, he's the most famous racehorse that, you know, a common person or anybody that's not really in horse racing knows. He's actually one of the top 50 athletes, considering he's a horse of all time. You know, my father was there that day, and him and Sham obviously were the two horses that were, you know, the main two rivals, and they were dueling in the first quarter of that 1973 Belmont, and people were yelling at Ron Turcotte. My father said he was looking around, people were yelling, even himself, and then when Secretariat started pulling clear, he said he looked around and he saw tears. He said people were crying. You know, 100,000 people, and, you know, growing up in Brooklyn and all of his friends to be able to witness that. That was a story, when I was 1 year old, you know, and for him to be there for that day, he always says that's, you know, one, besides being getting married to my mother, that was his best day ever to get to see a horse like that because, you know, he was just such a big fan.
Paul LaDuca joining us on the program. You know, Paul, I know exactly what you're talking about. You and I understand this. Horse people understand this, but you're talking about this like the way some people would talk about any NFL game or NBA game or Major League Baseball game that means so much to them. I know exactly what you're talking about. Then you come to the 99 Belmont Stakes, and at that time, you were in AAA playing for Albuquerque. You were rehabbing a broken hand. You and your father were talking about the field in the Belmont. What do you remember about that conversation, and what was the bet that you decided on that day?
Well, what happened was, Jim, my father had a heart attack on May 9th, okay? So he had it just after the Derby that year, and we were more concerned about him. We were really more concerned about the Preakness. We were not concerned about anything. I broke my hand, about a month into the season, so I'm on a rehab assignment. So now his doctor tells him, okay, you're allowed to bet now. You know, we don't want your heart to be racing too much. Make sure you take your medication. So I'm like, okay, so we get on the phone. We always get on the phone before every big race day. And you know what those are, the Triple Crown and the Breeders' Cup. So we always talk. And Charismatic was going for the Triple Crown for Dwayne Lucas. And then, obviously, we both had liked a horse More Than Ready and, Lemon Drop Kid. And at the end of the conversation, you know, my father goes, hey, I really like this new trainer, Bill Mott. And I'm like, okay, I like this horse, Vision and Verse. And I'm like, okay, Pop, you know, he hadn't played in so long or whatever. The horse, I looked at horse 51, and I'm like, it's one of those things, Jim, when you go, I'm not even going to ask him why. I'm like, I can't talk a guy, and I always say this, you never talk somebody off a long, long, long shot. I mean, because if they come in, you don't want to deal with it.
Right.
And you can talk somebody off a favorite and be like, okay, listen, we're not going to make that money. So what we did is we boxed Vision and Verse, Lemon Drop Kid. We threw Charismatic, who was going for the Triple Crown, and two other horses. So now I'm on rehab assignment in Albuquerque. Well, the lights go out in the stadium. We have a power outage. Okay? Now, payphones existed back in 1999. I go outside. I'm dialing my dad's number. I'm getting no answer. Nothing. So it's going out throughout the night. I got to start the game. And it's now 6:37, right in that area. The lights come back on. Everything comes back on. But in 1999, there's really no bottom line. There's no way of getting on the internet in a clubhouse. Now I got to play the game of finding who won the Belmont. No one cares who won the Belmont in 1999 at a AAA stadium. So I play the game. Still on the way home, I don't have a cell phone. I get home, I walk in my door, and the local news is saying big upset at the Belmont, and it's showing Lemon Drop Kid in vision reverse. I dropped my keys. So I get on a rotary phone, which I had in my apartment in Albuquerque, and call my father. He finally picks up the phone. I'm like, you've been warning me all day. What is going on? He's like, you're not going to believe this. I took so much medicine, I slept through the whole race.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, what do you mean? I go, check the account. He goes, what do you mean?
He had no idea.
We both slept through the Belmont, and we hit for 15,000, Jim. That's the only time I've never watched a Triple Crown race or my father. I couldn't watch it. My father slept through it. We both didn't watch it. When we saw that story, like, should we never watch the race again if we bet together?
Yeah, right, right. That's incredible, Paul. Like, and keep in mind, this is 1999. I mean, you literally can't get the result of something. Could you imagine not being able to get the result of any game or any matchup? This was 1999, not 1929, and your pops napped it out and you hit big. I mean, this is the thing. This is what people have, these amazing stories. So that brings us to this weekend. Paul LeDuc, my guest. Paul, let me ask you about Justify. You've been watching Justify in the Derby, the Preakness. You've seen him. He didn't run as a two-year-old. You've seen all his races. As a three-year-old, what impresses you the most about this animal, and do you think he gets it done?
Well, I think the mind on the animal. I respect Mike so much. I know you know Mike Smith, too. He's ridden for you in some big races, too, Jim. So when I've talked to Mike about him, he says, the mind on the horse is unbelievable. He's so smart. And that's the same things we used to hear about. You hear that all about the great horses. Your horse, misdirection. You hear that about American Pharoah. American Pharoah was brilliantly smart. He was like 70 people come around him. He was like a dog. And here was this champion horse that had the killer instinct on the racetrack. But when you took him off the racetrack, you could have a two-year-old pet him. And he says Justify is a lot like this. He's very smart, knows what's going on. And he really feels he's puffing up and getting better and better. And here's the thing. I do think he gets it done. And the reason why is you can maybe put an asterisk next to it. But listen, the second choice in this race would have been Audible by far, not even close. But in the game of horse racing, you have same owners. Windstar Farm and China Horse Club, they own Justify. Windstar Farm and China Horse Club, they own Audible. They're not going to run the same horse, their own horse against the other horse to ruin their Triple Crown. So that is going to help Justify big time, but he still has to deal with it. You know, every time you think they're a lock, you know the way it is, especially after they win the first two, everybody thinks they're a lock when it comes to Belmont. There's usually a hiccup, but I just think there's nobody in there that can beat him.
Paul LeDuc joining us. I mean, it is such a big ask. It's a tough thing. Hey, Paul, help me with this. You know what it's like to try to talk horse racing to the stick and ball crowd. I mean, back in the day, without banging my audience over the head, I tried to explain to them how special a horse shared belief was and what he meant to me. But, you know, a lot of times they don't want to hear it. They don't give a damn. Take it someplace else, roam. I think you can help me out here. You saw all of his races. You were on hand for some of his biggest races. If I can get you to just take a look back, when you think about Shared Belief, who passed away at four when he had colic, what are the memories you have of that horse? What did you think about that horse?
Wow, man, I got chills already. I think people forget that he went by California Chrome like he was tied to a tree. And, he was definitely a champion. It's a shame. I always wanted to call you, and I never didn't know when to. He was a Cadillac, Jim. He lowered so many horses. There's so many different horses. We talk about this in different sports. You know, LeBron James, everybody always talks about LeBron James being a freak. Well, how about his IQ? Dwight Howard's a freak. How come he doesn't do what he does? You know, how come there's this and that? Shared belief had an IQ, and he lowered himself like a Cadillac. You could physically see him lower himself down and sort of stride out wanting to go by you. I truly feel that he could have done even more. I mean, they anoint California Chrome, like I said, as a champion, and then they anoint Arrowgate, who went by him too, but they don't forget about your own shared belief. And it was a shame, because I truly believe he was the next coming, and he could have been that next best older horse. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. And I think a lot of people don't realize in horse racing, I say this a lot. I hit against Randy Johnson and 30,000 people. I hit against Adam Wainwright in game 7 in an NLCS, or to get to the World Series in Wap. And I wasn't as nervous doing my horse runs. And it's because it's out of your control. You cannot control it. But when they win, man, and you know it, it's the most exhilarating thing in the world.
It's so well said. What a great analogy. And Paul, I appreciate you. I really appreciate your thoughts on that. That means a lot to me. And you're right. We used to talk about that, right? He would lower himself to the ground, and he just knew. He just knew. Listen, you've got a podcast, you and Jeff Schwartz, and he's a great dude. You have a podcast called Embrace the Sweat. I know what that means. For those who don't, what does that mean, and how's that podcast going?
Well, Embrace the Sweat is basically, listen, gambling now, obviously, becoming legal everywhere. We want to educate people, two former players. We're not going to blow smoke. We're not going to try to tout you and give you picks. We're giving you picks here and there and try to educate you ways to wager. Because I don't want people to jump into the sports betting and wagering all this stuff on certain guys this, certain guys that. I'm trying to give you my knowledge of what I know on baseball. Jeff has given his knowledge, what he knows on football. And then the gist of it is, a lot of it is stories, like the stories we've been telling. Jeff's got so many great stories. I got so many great stories. Guys like you that we wanted to like get on the podcast have great stories of bad beats or good beats, even if it's not a gambling story or not. We talked to Mike Smith. He was our first guest, and he talked about his bad beat being Zenyatta for a lot of horse racing people, going for 20 in a row, losing by a nose. So the first episode was great. And you're right, Jeff is great. He wears so many hats, but he's got a tremendous NFL opinion. And listen, he was in the trenches for 10 years as an offensive lineman, so he's very knowledgeable.
Paul LaDuca, an analyst on the Action Network now, also an analyst on I'll Take That Bet, and the host of the podcast, Embrace the Sweat, and you've got the Belmont Stakes on Saturday. Hey, Paul, so good to get caught up. Really appreciate you. What a great conversation, man. That was so much fun. Have a great weekend. Let's make sure we do it again soon. And I really do appreciate your thoughts on Share Belief, Paul. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Jim. Thanks for having me on, man. Anytime.
Guys, just because you're graying out does not mean you have to live with that. And doing something about it does not mean a bucket of hair dye and a bunch of wrecked bath towels. Experience Control GX from Just for Men, the first shampoo with a brain. So what makes it so smart? It reduces gray the same way it grows in, gradually. The more you shampoo with Control GX, the less gray you have. Just use it until you like what you see. Now, how smart is that? Smart enough to be voted Men's Hair Care Product of the Year. Gradually reduce gray with the first shampoo with a brain. Find Control GX in the shave aisle. That's Control GX. All right, let's talk some baseball right now. The Giancarlo Stanton, Mike Fiers relationship, pretty tricky. Very complicated. It's actually not that complicated. The two of these guys meet up again yesterday. Stanton is now a Yankees slugger. Fiers now a Tigers pitcher. In the third inning, this happened.
Here's the 3-1 to Stanton, and it hit him. That's a hit batsman, not a walk. The ball came up and in. Stanton is giving a look to Fiers, and now McCann gets between Stanton and Fiers, and here come the players.
That, of course, is Yankees radio. Now, if you're thinking, it's not so bad, that's not so bad, don't forget, that's a rock being thrown at just under 90 miles per hour. And Stanton was not down, as you might imagine, especially when you consider the history the two of these guys have. You'll recall Fiers hit Stanton in the face back in 2014, busted his face, required multiple dental procedures. So I understand where Gio would not be all that pumped to see Fiers coming inside again and hitting him again. Hit me once and break my face. Maybe it's an accident. Hit me twice, well, then I'm not sure what the hell that is. I'm not sure what that is, but I'm going to do whatever I can to find out what that is. Now, that's not to say that it was intentional. Stanton knows that. Stanton said, quote, "He wasn't trying to hit me tonight, but still, with that history, don't hit me." That doesn't eliminate pitching inside. This is the major leagues. But either get it over the plate or make sure it doesn't hit me, end quote. That makes sense to me. I know you're not trying to hit me, but since you've already hit me in the face in the past and caused a ton of damage, how about you just don't hit me again? It's not that hard. And again, Stanton's not saying that Fiers can't pitch inside. But if he can't pitch inside without dotting him, then yeah, maybe you don't pitch inside. Do what you want as a pitcher, but if you've already hit me in the face and blasted chiclets out of my head, just don't hit me. And, you know, to be real, I don't think that's unfair. A batter asking that the pitcher not hit him seems like a pretty fair request, especially if that same pitcher has already hit him in the face. Now, I don't think for a second that Fires was trying to hit him back in 2014. I'm not saying that at all. His reaction would tell you that that's the case. His reaction would tell you at that time that's not what he meant to do. And I also don't think that he was trying to hit Stanton yesterday either. But when you do it twice, you've kind of run out of excuses. Maybe you just throw outside for a while. Or better yet, don't pitch to this guy at all. Because in the sixth inning, this is what happened.
Now here's the 0-2. Swung on. It goes to left. It is high. Not as far. It is gone. Mike Fires delivered in, and Stanton hit it out in left field. Giancarlo, no si puesto palo. Boy, I don't think that doesn't make him happy. A Stantonian blast, and the Yankees trail 3-2.
Bet that felt pretty damn good. Of course he stared it down, and he flipped his bat, and then he capped off his trip around the bases with a little point to the mound. And Fires didn't like that at all. His response was, and I quote, "I understand that he's pissed, but the way he handled it was kind of childish. He's going to act how he's going to act, but it kind of shows his character. Getting his revenge and throwing his bat and pointing, that's not part of this game. Yeah, you're supposed to have fun, but I think that's kind of childish," end quote. Yeah, I think I agree or disagree with you, Mike. It's not childish. I'll tell you what is childish. Getting all bent because that guy just did that. You don't hit this guy a second time after shattering his face and expect him to react otherwise. I doubt he's reacting the way he did if you don't hit him twice. Better yet, don't hit him the first time, and then he's not going to react that way either. But if you hit this guy twice, and if he has to wear those pitches, and especially wear one in his face, you need to wear that you threw those pitches and that he just turned one around about 900 feet. Listen, you see that thing that he wears on his helmet, that face protector? It's because of you. You did that. So if you hit this guy again, hell yes, he's going to be pissed. And if he homers off you, there probably is going to be a little extra emotion in that jog around the bases. That face protector is a reminder of the fact that you could have ended this guy's career and worse. Remember what he said after that went down. Here's a quick quote from after he was hit in the face. Quote, "My ears were ringing. I couldn't hear nothing except the ring. I was checking my mouth, just the blood, mouth full, and having chunks of teeth floating around." Chunks of teeth floating around in a mouth full of blood, and the guy couldn't hear anything except the ringing in his head. You got a feeling because a guy drills you in the face, you got to have a feeling that you can pretty much react any way you want if you hit one out afterwards, if you get hit a second time. I mean, again, this guy had a procedure to determine how much blood was in his sinus cavity. He was hitting the left side of the face, and there was blood found in his right sinus. That's how hard that guy was hit. So I'm going to say no, it's not that childish for him to be a little pumped up when you hit him again, and then he goes yard. You got to own that and not complain about that. Man, complaining about that's childish. If you don't like this guy acting like that, keep him in the yard. If you don't like this guy acting like that, stop hitting him in the face. If you don't like this guy acting like that, get the guy out. None of this is on Stanton. All of it's on you. Where do you come out on that? 1-800-636-8686. Damn straight the guy's going to watch a home run for a second or two. Damn straight there's going to be a bat flip involved. Damn straight he's going to take his time going around the bases and point at the mound after you hit him a second time. You got to wear that. You got to wear that like he had to wear that pitch that you hit him in the face with. Dion Lewis is my guest. Dion, really nice to have you on today. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. All right, so you've been at OTAs with your new team. I'm curious, what's that experience like? Is that kind of like that deal where you feel like the new kid at this new school, or does it all feel pretty normal?
It feels pretty normal, you know, just being in the league for a long time, you know, just adjusting to my new teammates. you know, trying to get used to everybody, new coaches and everything. So it's definitely an exciting time.
Deion Lewis, my guest. Speaking of new coaches, what are your early impressions of head coach Mike Vrabel?
Oh, man, he's a great coach. You know, he's full of energy. He brings the same mentality every day. He expects a lot out of us, and he's accountable himself as well. So it's definitely great to have a guy like that, and I think he'd be great for us.
We're talking to Deion Lewis, and you're joining a backfield where you've got Derrick Henry, and I know the two of you have had some time or a chance to spend some time together. I mean, Derrick Henry, my man, is a big, big dude. Take me back. What did you think when you first saw him in person and when you first met him?
When I first met him in person, he was a lot bigger than I thought he was. You know, so I'm only 5'7", so he's definitely, you know, about 6'3", 6'4". But, you know, he's a good guy, a great guy to be around, works hard. And our lockers are right next to each other, so we spend a lot of time talking. I'm learning about each other, learning the offense together, so it's definitely great to have a teammate like him.
You know, I wonder, the two of you guys have different running styles, but at the same time, he loves how physical and how tough you are. As you prepare for the season, how much do you think that the two of you are going to kind of inspire each other and even feed off each other?
I think it could be great, you know, just being able to compete with each other all training camp and work together at the same time. So I definitely think, you know, us competing against each other and trying to make each other better and pushing each other would definitely help the team a lot. So I'm definitely excited for that, and I think we'll work together as well as also.
Talking to Deion Lewis, you know, I'm looking at that offense, and you guys have so many weapons with that Titans offense, but the thing that keeps getting repeated is it's all going to start with the running game. How much pride do you take in the fact that the team is counting on you and Derrick the way that it is?
It's a great feeling. You know, as a running back, you want the ball a lot, you know what I'm saying? So, but for us to establish a running game, I think that helps everybody, you know, the O-line, the quarterback, the receiver. So I think it starts with the running backs. And if me and Derrick could get things going on the ground, I definitely think it will help the success.
I mentioned all your stats at the top. Yeah, I was going to say, Deion, you had a really good year. A really good year. I mentioned your stats off the top. So during free agency, there were a lot of teams that were interested in you. What was it about this opportunity with the Titans that appealed to you the most? How did you end up there?
You know, just playing that. We played against them in the playoffs. You know, they had a great team. They were very competitive. We beat them guys, obviously, but you know, going into that game, watching them on film, you can see what type of team they were and where they were headed. And they're a young, hungry team. And when Coach Vrabel got the job, you know, that was a big signing. And I've had a teammate, Logan Ryan, who I played with in the past, who had nothing but great things to say about the city. So, you know, just a whole bunch of things, and I felt very comfortable. And I think that, you know, we could do some special things here.
Hey, listen, I know why they wanted you. You had 141 all-purpose yards in that game in the playoffs, so I know why they were looking at you. You know, let me go back to the time that when you signed with the Titans, it was a really special day because people may or may not remember this, but when you were coming out of high school, you didn't have a ton of offers. What do you remember about that time, and then what kind of thoughts were you having about your football future then?
You know, just in high school, you know, just not having, you know, too many schools look at me because I was a smaller guy. So, you know, I just always had to work harder than everybody and just try to be the best I can. So just going through that experience, just always keeping that same mentality that I got to go out there and prove myself every chance I get. So I just kind of carry that, and I'm going to continue to carry that this year as well.
You know, I think you're a great story in the sense that you played your college ball at Pittsburgh, and then you were drafted in the fifth round by Philadelphia, and then you were traded to Cleveland where you were injured, and you spent a short time with the Colts, and then you went to the Patriots. And then you have an ACL injury in New England, and at that point, a lot of people might have just given up, but you didn't. How come and what kept you going?
You know, just the way I was brought up, you know, I always believe in myself. I'm very confident in my abilities, and I know that, you know, I can bounce back from anything. So whether it's just good things going on or bad things going on, tough times or good times, you know, I'm always going to stay level-headed and keep working. So no matter how bad things get or good things get, you know, I'm going to continue to be true to myself and keep working and try to go out there and show people what I could do.
Titans running back Deion Lewis joining us. So you did bounce back. You bounced back and you had a huge 2017 season. And then you're able to sign with the Titans in March. And you have family members who are there with you to celebrate. When you consider everything you've been through, the things that we just talked about, what did it mean to you to sign that deal with the Titans and then to share that moment with everybody who stood by you and supported you?
I meant a lot, you know, just because, you know, my family, you know, they've always believed in my abilities and they've never doubted me. And they've always been by my side during the ups and downs. So just to have them there and share that moment with them, it meant a lot. But, you know, at the same time, you know, my mentality is always the same. I'm going to just keep going out there, keep working hard, and try to prove myself and try to show people I'm deserving.
Julian Edelman was the guy who gets credit for nicknaming you Jitterbug. And throughout your career, teammates have always raved about how seeing you make a defender miss gets them fired up. Can you take me through a play? What's it feel like when you make a guy miss that badly? And do you notice how much that gets your teammates going?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just, you know, I try to go out there and play hard and get my team a little spark whenever I can, especially nothing gives your team a spark more than, you know, making a guy miss or breaking the tackle and making a play. So that's what I try to do, and I just try to give my energy, my team energy, so they can feed off it. And then that's how you go out there and win games, when you provide your team with energy. And I think that I'm an energy player. You know, I play hard every play like it's my last, so I think definitely that could rub off on a few guys.
Hey, Deion, you mentioned that you're not the biggest guy, but you are tough. We know this. So I'm curious, what is more rewarding to you? Would you rather make a guy miss completely or break a tackle?
Break a tackle, because, you know, if you break a tackle, that sets everything else up, and then you can make guys miss, and you can kind of keep them all balanced. So, you know, I just like, you know, setting guys up, either running through a tackle first, and then they think I'm running through it, and then I run around them. So, you know, just try to take whatever they give me, really.
All right, so last thought. You've been to a Super Bowl. You have won a Super Bowl. You know what it takes to win a Super Bowl. I know you're still early with your new team, but you do know about this club. Does it feel like the right pieces are in place and this group has the right set to contend for or even win a Super Bowl?
You know, I think that we have a lot of talent on this team, and I think everybody's hungry, and that's the one thing I like about this team. And watch those come here. Everybody's hungry, and nothing has ever been given to anybody on this team. So I think we definitely have the right mindset to come out and compete and earn everything that we get. So I like the group of guys we have, and I definitely think that we could, if we continue working hard every day like we have been, learning a new playbook with the new coaching staff and all that, I think this is the time that you start to see that in guys. And this is the most important time this in training camp. So I definitely think that we're heading in the right direction.
He's a Super Bowl champion with a brand new opportunity. Deion Lewis signs with the Tennessee Titans in the offseason. Deion, really good to have you on the show. Thanks for the conversation. Appreciate it very much.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Minnesota Nice. I saw this firsthand. When I was at the Super Bowl last year, the hospitality was just off the charts. People could not have been more welcoming. People could not have been nicer. The state opened up its arms and played host to us in a magnificent way. Me, hell, they were nice to Hawk. They treated Hawk like he was somebody special and unique. Even a few thousand Eagle fans who descended upon them early in the week, they couldn't help but remind Minnesotans that their team just got shredded in the NFC Championship game and missed out on a shot to play a home game in the Super Bowl, and everybody was still nice. Nobody said a word. Minnesota Nice. But apparently, Minnesota Nice does not apply in the town of Redwood Falls, because this small town, which is about 120 miles southwest of the Twin Cities, ran the most savage obituary in the history of obits. And while most people have heard the phrase, "Don't speak ill of the dead," most people are not Gina and Jay. We talked about Gina and Jay. Gina and Jay waited until their estranged mom, Kathleen, was 6 feet under before sending her into the afterlife with maybe the most devastating 1-2 punch that I have ever seen. Check this obit out. Check it out, then duck for cover. And again, if I'm just talking about some random obit on this show, you know it's awesome. I'm going to read this obit exactly as it's written. Kathleen Demlow Shunk was born on March 19th, 1938, to Joseph and Gertrude Shunk of Wabasso. She married Dennis Demlow at St. Anne's in Wabasso in 1958 and had two children, Gina and Jay. In 1962, she became pregnant by her husband's brother, Lyle Demlow, and moved to California. She abandoned her children, Gina and Jay, who were then raised by her parents in Clements, Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Shunk. She passed away on May 31st, 2018 in Springfield, and will now face judgment. She will not be missed by Gina and Jay, and they understand that this world is a better place without her. Straight freaking obituary fire. God, I can't tell you how badly I want to read that again. That is, and I will read that again really quickly, really quickly. Kathleen Demlow Schunk was born on March 19, 1938, to Joseph and Gertrude Schunk of Wabasso. She married Dennis Demlow at St. Anne's in Wabasso. In 1958, they had two kids, Gina and Jay. In 1962, she became pregnant by her husband's brother. This woman got with her husband's brother and moved to California. Not only got with her husband's brother and moved, but got with her husband's brother and moved and abandoned the kids, Gina and Jay, who were then raised by the mother's parents. She passes away on May 31st, 2018, quote, and will now face judgment. Quote, she will not be missed by Gina and Jay. Quote, they understand this world is a better place without their mother. Straight obituary fire. And that is one of the most outwardly bitter things I've ever seen. Mountains and mountains of salt poured onto an 80-year-old's grave 56 years after she and her brother-in-law, Lyle, had a steamy night in a small town in Minnesota that ended up with her running off to California and never seeing her two kids again. Hey, look, I'm not here to make fun of a family getting ripped apart. Far from it. Far from it. I've seen it happen. It's horrible. Nobody would ever wish that on their worst enemy. But I will say this. If you thought that time would heal all wounds, apparently, that is not true in the case of Gina and Jay. Because 56 years later, these two people are still pissed. 56 years later, two fully grown adults waited until their mom was in the ground before they went scorched earth and hit the Redwood Gazette with the most bitter, flame-throwing lava obit in the history of the medium. Listen, we'll never know if Kathleen made peace with Dennis, or stuck with Lyle, or lived a fulfilled life out here in California. But we know one thing. You can mess with a lot of different people, but you do not want to mess with Gina and Jay. And without knowing the details, if what they say is true, I am team Gina and Jay. If mom really did run off with her husband's brother and abandon little Gina and Jay, I am team G and J, if that's how that went down. Either way, that is the gnarliest obit I've ever read in my life. That is some lava. I mean, doesn't every other obit read the same way? Wonderful father, amazing leader in his church, great citizen, tremendous contributor to the community, a man of great faith and resolve, ran off with our father's brother and abandoned us. See you in hell, mom. Wow. Like I said, for me to go off the board with something like that, it had to be different. We are joined by Igor Kokoshkov. Igor, it's really nice to have you on the program. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for doing it. Let me start with the fact that you were an assistant with the Suns earlier in your career, and you became a citizen in a ceremony on the court at Talking Stick Resort Arena, and you said that your family views Phoenix as home. So having said all that, how does it feel to be coming back to Phoenix as the head coach of the Suns?
Feels great. Feels great. And really, this is our home. We actually never left Phoenix as a city. We moved here from 2008. My wife is from Michigan, and we always felt this is the place we want to be. From those 5 years when I was here coaching from 2008 to 2013, really, I keep nothing but a great memories, and it was really fun time to be around, being fortunate to be around Steve Nash and Grant Hill. We had a really good squad, good people, and good players, and. You know, making NBA Western Conference Finals was a fun time. Really, something that I'll never forget as long as I'm in this business. But like I said, this is a place where we always felt comfortable and as a family, and being back here in the Suns family really It's a fun time. It's just feel great.
Right, so those were great teams. Let's talk about what you're inheriting. Your GM, Ryan McDonough, said that one of the things that impressed him in speaking with you was that you knew the Suns team so well already and that you've got ways that you think are going to help to develop that team. When you look at this squad, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Well, I don't have a magic stick. I don't have something that I'm going to just show up. And obviously, you have a concept, you have an idea. I think I bring flexibility to adjust to the personnel that we have and that we're going to have starting next season. So as a coach, as a young coach, you always mentioned, I mentioned it a couple of times, you don't have philosophy, you have thoughts and opinions, and you have to come up with flexibility. We know who our best players are. When you describe any team, and same thing, describing our team, description comes with your best players. We know we have a young squad, young team. I don't think, like I said, I don't have I don't bring magic with me. I know that we have to establish different culture and. Seems like every coach is bringing and changing culture, but when I talk about culture, means there's no shortcuts in this business. We know what it takes. You need ingredients, you need a talent, you need a guys who are willing to play together, to sacrifice for a team, and it's a long path, but it's not easy. If it'd be easy, anybody can do it. So we know that we know what it takes and requires for us to get back to those days when this organization were one of the top in NBA.
Igor Kokoshkov is the Suns head coach. He joins us. Igor, I know you'll tell me it's about the players, but if you can you make it about you? Because your background really is fascinating. As an example, you were an excellent point guard growing up, and then 3 days before you signed your first pro contract, you were driving out of Belgrade when a car swerved into your path. It collided with your Fiat. You injured your knee and your ankle, and it resulted in 4 surgeries over the next 8 months. Can you tell me what you remember about that accident and the recovery process?
Well, you just mentioned it. You know a lot about my history. It's scary. But,
right.
People ask me how was my game and what position, who was my favorite player, and what was my basically upside as a player. And my question back is, do you remember me as a player? And the answer is no, so I wasn't good enough. So. Unfortunately, I had a car accident when I was 18 years old, and it changed my life. Then I realized that I won't be able to play professionally basketball. Excuse me. Since basketball requires a lot of athleticism, your body has to be ready and strong. And at that point, I was 18 years old. I understood that, I'll never be able to recover that well that I can professionally play basketball. But, my heart was always, my mind was always in the sports, in the basketball, and I never had a doubt that I'm going to stay in the sports. So, from this perspective, maybe it's easier for me to say it, but I knew I'm going to be a coach. I didn't know that I'm going to coach Phoenix Suns, but at that time, I knew I'm going to be on the court and teaching the game of the basketball.
At the same time, those who were around you at that time said that they knew you were a natural for coaching and that it did not surprise them at all. In fact, you were an assistant with Quinn Snyder at Missouri and again with Utah Jazz. Let me ask you about your time with him. What was your biggest takeaway with Quinn, and what did you learn from him?
We're not just a colleague. So obviously, I worked for him for 4 years. Last 4 years, I spent with Utah Jazz. Our relationship is not just coach to coach. I mean, we're really close friends. I met Quinn Snyder in 97 when he was associate head coach at University of Duke, working for Coach Krzyzewski. That's where everything started. Coach Snyder is brilliant, very smart man, and you can tell in many, many ways he's an entrepreneur and innovator in the game of basketball. So he was the guy who had a kind of feel and sense and he was anticipating where the game is going to be in 15 years, now 20 years from now, and about internationalization of the game and globalization. And so we just established a great relationship, became really close friends. He gave me a first job at the University of Missouri. That was my first job in basically moving to the United States. And what I learned from Coach Snyder is a lot. I mean, he's very organized and a very detail oriented coach, great motivator, and really we built together. You know, that team started from also just like we're starting right now, something completely new, and starting offensive philosophy, defense philosophy, terminology, everything was new, and you know, I. Even if I don't want to, I, you know, like after 4 years working with someone, it's just a part of my coaching, you know, philosophy at this moment. I also, as a coach, work with a lot of good coaches, a lot of successful coaches, you know, Alvin Gentry, Larry Brown, and Flip Saunders, Mike Brown. So, you know, as a coach, you're trying to take the best and from all of them. And at the end of the day, you have to be who you are and you have to be honest to yourself. So I don't think you can be a replica of Queen or Larry Brown. I don't think that would be the answer. But, you know, you can definitely learn and steal. We call it steal. We're stealing from each other. And incorporating something you call, this is what I think, and this is how I see basketball game.
Igor, you are fast becoming the most interesting man in the NBA. All those coaches that you referenced, I've had on this show over the years, and they're all so fascinating. You know, you mentioned Alvin Gentry, because after your time with Quinn in Missouri, you went to the Clippers as an assistant with Alvin Gentry, and that was a big leap from Belgrade to Missouri to the Clippers in a very short time. So as you look back on that time, what was the most challenging part of it? Was it the basketball side of life or everything else that wasn't basketball?
It was, from this perspective, was a fun time. There was one of the youngest team in the history of the NBA with Lamar Odom and Corey Maggette and Keon Dooling that I coached at the University of Missouri. So for me, it was spending 1 year in college basketball was quite enough. Consider the fact that I never went to school here, never played college basketball. The, you know, NBA world was I felt more comfortable being around NBA world than college basketball. You know, I didn't have to deal with recruiting and dealing with the young players and academics, all this stuff that it was kind of unknown territory for me. But, you know, NBA is pure basketball, pure coaching, player developing, game preparation, and that's something what I did all my life. So, really, you know, it was a fun time. L.A. was a quite different place than Columbia, Missouri. And it took some time for me to adjust, but it was a fun time. It was a fun time, a fun team to coach, a lot of young players. Even our first year, we had, you know, I think the best record in second best record in the West in the second part of the season, which was we really showed some huge improvement in a time when Alvin Gentry was coaching. So it was really, really fun time being in L.A.
A couple of things before you go, I got to ask you about, you said Columbia, Missouri is very different than L.A. It's interesting because I'm a Los Angeles native and I live in Southern California and I've got a son who's a junior in high school and we're looking at colleges right now and he went to Missouri. He went to Columbia and he absolutely loved it. So I'm curious, what was Columbia like for you when you first got there and lived there and worked there?
Well, it was different, but focused. My focus was only on basketball. I showed up basically a week before, the season was starting, before Midnight Madness, and my focus was right away to the office and basketball and helping Coach Snyder to put some playbook together, and it was really, really fun time and good place and great school also. They're really dedicated. They were trying to win, and really, I think that it was a time that really enjoyed being in college basketball. But being 1 year in college basketball, I think it was a plenty for me because, you know, again, I was searching for a new challenge, and at the time I didn't know, but I was ready for NBA.
You get a great challenge right now. Last thought, I mentioned this off the top, but you are the first head coach born and raised outside North America. Do you feel any extra pressure as a result of that, that maybe you're representing other coaches from around the world, or does that really just not matter at all?
When it comes to the winning and losing, it doesn't really matter at all. I mean, you can get it done and you can coach or you cannot. I mean, it's a more factor, something that media is kind of playing with, and it's fun for fans maybe to have something different could be intriguing, could be something different. It's somebody who's got a strong accent when he talks. But, you know, when it comes to XO, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you speak from the heart and you know game or you don't. We'll see. I mean, I have a little pressure and feel a little pressure in a way that, you know, this project, if this this experiment doesn't really sustain, then maybe, you know, like American public is gonna question, do we need a foreign coaches because we invented this game and we're the best in the world. But you know, on the other side, on the flip side, I've been, you know, in this league for 18 years. I consider myself an NBA coach. So it just I think there's only two kind of coaches. You know, you can get it done and you can win or lose and nothing in between. So, you know, but maybe I was too, you know, just a lucky guy to get a job, and if I'm good enough to keep the job, then it's going to be the proof of the quality. I think lasting in anything, in any business, is the proof of the quality.
My man, you just won the day. I know you dominated this show, Igor. I can't tell you, I cannot tell how happy I am to have you on the program and to meet you and to talk basketball with you. Listen, thank you so much for that. Have a great day. I hope we can do it again. I really enjoyed that very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day.
Here in California, Modesto, Brad. Brad, what's going on? Good to have you. How are you?
Hey, thanks a lot, man. What a pleasure and an honor to speak to you, Jim. I'm 39, about to go on 40. Been listening to you since I was a teenager, man. Just wanted to give the clones a little heads up. Don't wait in line at the grocery store or the gas station anymore without tapping someone on the shoulder in front of you and turning behind you and borrowing their phone. All you have to do is hit that message bubble, 96,000, type send 800. There you go.
Hey, Brad, are you really doing that? I mean, are you standing in line in stores and saying, hey, yo, can I borrow your phone, and then texting out the vote?
I have twice. At the gas station, the guy behind the counter, who I know really well, Patriot fan, I borrowed his phone and did it and told him what I did. But there's been two other people when I went to the grocery store last night who, honestly, they don't have any idea how much they just contributed to you getting in the Hall of Fame, man.
My man, Brad, I appreciate you so much. Stay strong. This is exactly, you're the best, Brad. That's what I'm saying. You got to get creative with it. Now, when I said get creative, I don't know if I meant that creative, but my man Brad's doing it. Let's go to Huntington Beach. Silk. Silk bra. What's up, Silk?
Hey, Jimmy. How you doing, buddy?
I'm great,
hey,
Silk.
Listen, I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night, and if somehow we can get Alvy's vasectomy on the schedule, I'll gladly do it on my surfboard at the beach. Kimmo.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
That's not Silk. That's the fake Silk. I always get hyped up. I love Silk.
Come
Whenever
on.
I see Silk on the call screen, I get hyped up. And then the second I hear that bag's voice,
Come
I
on.
Immediately get brought down.
Bruh.
That's Silk. This other
Come
guy, hey, Jimmy. And then I just wait for it. Then I just wait for the punchline that he inevitably will chase with, come on.
Come on.
Good night now!